Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, we have Grace Berg and Andrew File on the show of the Every Neighborhood Partnership Organization. Grace is the Development and Communications Coordinator at ENP. After 10 years in the church and parachurch space, Grace is excited to bring her understanding of ministry relations and communication skills to the Every Neighborhood Partnership. Andrew File serves as the Executive Director of the Every Neighborhood Partnership. Beyond his leadership role at EMP, he also served as adjunct faculty at Fresno Pacific University in the School of Humanities, Religion, and Social Sciences, bringing his wealth of experience to the academic sphere. Andrew envisions a future where everyone possesses the ability to be decision makers, contributing to the creation of healthy and thriving neighborhoods. We cover a lot of topics in this conversation, a lot related to community development, economic relationships, church's role in community development, and a lot more. I know you'll enjoy this conversation. Let's go meet Andrew and Grace. Convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best. Andrew and Grace, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Oh, I love to eat all over the city. Mostly, I live in the Tower District, so I'm mostly going to places there. India's Oven is a favorite. I just had Don Tacha, which is on Belmont and Blackstone. So, but yeah, mostly urban and greasy and good.
Well, Andrew introduced me to Chef Paul's, and the first time I went there, I had a spiritual experience. That's one of my favorites. And then Moto Deli, now on Echo, has become a fast favorite.
So. You were just saying the Annex is your, like,
that's like my bougie, date night. Let's spend some dollars. Yeah. So,
okay. So two questions for each of you, or two questions, one for each of you. So Andrew, define for you what good Indian food looks like. And then Grace, what is your sandwich order at Moto?
Good Indian food. I like to sweat a little bit. So that is like, and my go-to order, my wife likes sweet stuff. So she's going with your buttered chicken, right? So that's got to be creamy. It needs to taste like butter a little bit. And then I've been going with like a saag paneer mostly. So yeah, so those have been our, and then garlic naan, you got to have garlic naan. So yeah, that's it.
Those are great things. During COVID, one of the things that I did is I really mastered butter chicken at home.
Okay.
Or at least I think I did. You know, there's only a few people that've had it, so I can't confirm. But I will say the strategy is that grass-fed butter from Costco, you cut off like a half section of it and then just drop it into the vat. And you just kind of watch it disappear, and then it disappears into your tummy. Grace, what about you in terms of sandwiches?
I'm getting the Goodfellas. Okay. I'm asking for extra garlic mayo and extra pesto because we love life.
Yeah.
And we love good things. So that's what I'm getting when I'm going to Moto. I love that you use the words butter vat together in a sentence because that's just good food. So I appreciated that.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I encounter people that they try to cut corners with things. So like they try to do everything healthy. And I think that is insane and not the right way to live. I think
you gotta enjoy some things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like for a while, I've been watching these videos of this guy who's trying to live forever. His name's Brian Johnston. And he's like spending $2 million a year to kind of hack his body. And then, you know, he shows what he eats every day. And my partner and I have been talking about this. Like, at what point are you just living to live and you're, you know, instead of just living? And so I support all the butter, all the bread, obviously in moderation.
I saw his like pill regimen. I saw something about that recently and I was like, that's insane.
Yeah, that it feels like, what's the phrase, missing the forest for the trees? All right. So we're going to jump in and talk about a lot of things, ENP. I want to first talk about some of the values you listed, because there's some things I want to kind of engage you guys on. The first is on your value section on your organization's page, you describe it as being Jesus-centered. Now, one issue I have with this is Jesus can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So I grew up Baptist and then became an Episcopalian later in life. And if I created kind of a summary sheet of their descriptions of Jesus, they would seem like two wildly different people living in two different time periods and geographical places that are wildly different. So why just use that simple word without having a specificity in what you mean by that attached?
Yes, that confounds and frustrates many people who work with us or want to work with us. So I think the idea, right, there's a mathematical, the centered piece, this is a mathematics term, I'm not, wasn't great at math, but the idea is that what we often do, religion, what religion functions as, is it gives us boundaries and rules and ways of being and like a culture to live within. But what religion does on a bad day is we draw a boundary, right? So we say, this is the boundary line. This is who is in. This is who is out of the thing. And whatever moral circle, you're conservative, right? You're going to say homosexuality is outside that bound. Liberals are going to say you don't care for racial justice. You're outside that bound. So we all, everybody does this. We create a boundary. That is a way to do religion. That is a way to do life. That is a way to do faith. I don't think it's a beautiful way to do those things. Instead, what we should do, and I think what you see Jesus often doing, is he like really pisses off the religious folks that he's around, because he doesn't say it's where the boundary line is, it's where you're moving. So you could be like, for all intents and purposes, very religious. You know, there's like a group of folks that are around him and they are giving 10% of their spice rack to follow, because that's, it's a give 10%. So they're giving 10% of everything to the temple. Jesus is like, dude, you guys don't care. Like, you don't actually love and serve others. You're not living a faithful life. You're going the wrong way. You're moving away from me. And then you have folks that are on the way, you know, prostitutes, tax collectors, people that were the worst of the worst. And Jesus is like, that person gets it, because their directional arrow is pointed to Jesus. So I think so much for us, like we work with, as an organization, if you want to, you know, we say we partner with people of good faith and goodwill. You want to do something meaningful in the world, we're down. So whether it is the city, whether it's a business, whether it's a church, we work with churches that are very conservative and we work with churches that are very progressive. For me, the Jesus way and the like prototypical example of what Jesus was about is just like the most beautiful story I know. And so I'm going to put my hat on that rack. But yeah, we're not going to draw that boundary line, and we're going to serve the city together.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense to me, keeping it fairly neutral and letting people come to their own conclusions. Yeah. Now, you kind of already tipped your hat to my next question, which was the strengths and weaknesses of using churches as community partners. Mm-hmm. We know that there's strengths and we definitely know that there's weaknesses. Can you describe some of those?
So I'd say strengths, it's part of their DNA. So this is most faith communities, especially most Christian faith communities, like literally love your neighbor, right? Jesus in the New Testament said, hey, two laws I give you, love God, love others. And so this sense that like it's built, it should be built in the vision and what the world is about for a Christian community. So that's a strength. Like you don't have to convince somebody to serve. It's part of what they should already be doing. You have a group of mobilized, organized people who have a structure. That is actually like really helpful, that you can talk to somebody and say, hey, we'd love to help you serve at this place. We can help. They have an announcements. They have structures. They have systems, right? It's like working with Rotary or any other nonprofit group. They're already set up. So that's a huge strength. And I think for me, I think in this current modern context, I think a challenge is those religious communities are fractured and frayed. Post-pandemic, a lot of folks have left churches. Churches are trying to figure out how to just run their own internal systems and let alone thinking outside the walls. We're seeing that change a little bit post-COVID, like just now. Churches are just thinking mm-hmm. external again. So that's a huge challenge. And then I think, you know, when a church comes with an orientation, we don't experience this, but I know some folks have, when churches come with an orientation of say, like, you're going to do it our way, or, you know, we're only here to evangelize. Like, we're only here to see you convert. That can be a really huge downfall. Mm-hmm. And so we only work with churches that want to be a blessing. Like, that's the language we use. You know, if folks somewhere down the line have a chance to engage that church, be a part of the church, I love that. But that's not the way and the posture and the starting point that you should have as you engage our city. So I think those are probably two on each side. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say too, it's never been EMP like pulling churches to come and serve. We started in 2008 because church leaders got together and said, how can we be more like fully holistically invested in a neighborhood? And so that's how it started, was that three churches came together and started essentially a nonprofit with one another. And so it's always been like very true to our name. Like, it's always been a partnership. It's always been collaborative. And hopefully we've created an environment that it's open ways of communication that we're having honest conversations along the way of like, hey, I see you leaning, like what Andrew's talking about, towards a more like you come in with the problem, like the fix it mentality. And we can very quickly and gently be like, hey, that's not the best way. So.
Well, you use one of those buzzwords that's getting circulated around and is slowly losing its ability to have meaning, which is equity. What are some of the biggest misconceptions you see in the ways people understand the word equity?
Oh, baby. How much time you got?
30 seconds. No, as long as you need.
No, I mean, like I sit at a really interesting intersection. I'll just use myself as an example. I'm from Bakersfield. Let's go. Actually, I don't, you know, I'm not there anymore. So, but I sit at an interesting intersection of like white, suburban, hetero, male, like I'm all the things, right? This pyramid of power. I'm like at the top of it or something, you know? And so but I'm leading an organization that engages mostly Southern Fresno, mostly urban, mostly Latino, you know, Latino like culture, Spanish speaking. So I'm an outsider. And so I think equity for me really is about everybody having the equal opportunity to succeed. That's like the dream of that word, that everybody's not starting from the same place. So we do need to kind of go back and think about who have we neglected, who have we left out. I think there is a thing that we don't want to be a part of, where I think one of our like visions is to create a world of abundance and win-wins. I think what often happens right now in this like social justice space is that it's everybody fighting for this like slice of the pie. Like there's only this X amount and we all have to fight over it. And so everybody's yelling and fighting for their slice of equity, their slice of the pie. And we want to live in a world of abundance where we do need to address the wrongs of the past. So we do classes on racial equity, racial justice. We have one coming up. We're launching called Living Undivided. It's intentional conversations around race. But we also, so we're going to address it. But I also like experience a lot of shame, a lot of manipulation that comes from folks that are also fighting for equity, but that don't co-partner, that don't believe the best. And so, yeah, I sit at an interesting intersection where I feel the brunt of that question a little bit, but I know it's our organization's dream to see like everybody with a new future working together.
Yeah. Equity all the way around, like for the people that we serve, but also for the partners that we partner with, the organizations that we work with. You cannot put out your hand and keep a fist behind. So I would say that it's equity internally as well, and not just externally.
In your collaboration section, you talk a lot about valuing and honoring the contributions of others in your work. This comes from my personal experience too. How do you evaluate the trustworthiness of a community partner? There is a lot of hucksters out there in the nonprofit space that are looking for grant money to do X, Y, and Z. They're maybe a little fishy in their measurements and their ability to show you the efficacy of their project. How do you determine someone's a trustworthy partner? Is it just time spent, or are there kind of other measures that you use that make it helpful for you to be able to evaluate them as a partner?
It's time and then user experience, right? So, and this is like something we try and guard against for ourselves is like when we hear critique or we hear a pushback that like, hey, EMP did this or did that, like we got to listen and learn. Sometimes, you know, it's a really valid critique of us. And I'm like, okay, we got to be better. Sometimes it's just like somebody's really negative Yelp review, right? One star, they're the worst. And you're going to have people that don't like what you do and you just got to let it go. But I think, yeah, there's times over the last couple of years where I keep hearing something about a partner that we work with. I keep hearing it. You see it in their, maybe in their storytelling, right? Like the way they're kind of like using others in their storytelling, or there's a ton of different examples here. But just over time, it builds to where sometimes if I know them well, I'll have a conversation because I would love to hear that stuff. Like sometimes as leaders, you don't hear the critique, you just hear the positive. And so I've passed on some information where I said, hey, just this is a word that's getting said about you all a lot. And I'd love to know that. Sometimes then we're just going to stop also working with somebody because it's like, I don't want to put my name on their thing. I don't want to be associated with the way they re-victimize people that they're supposed to be helping, right? Or, you know,
that makes sense.
Selfish.
To me.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One more question on the value section is about self-care. I'm married to a clinical psychologist, so we talk about self-care a lot. And I'm going to give you an either or. I'm going to make you choose a 51%. Because sometimes when I tell people either or, they're like, oh, it's both. And it's like, that's fine. But I'm curious which one you think it's more of. You think it's more of an organization's responsibility to ensure self-care or the individual? Hmm. And you can say 51%. So it's a little bit more one way. You know, you can do a little both, but no cop-outs.
Can I answer this one?
Yeah.
Because I'm on staff.
Yeah.
I would say it's on the individual 51%. And I say that because EMP does organizationally, like every month we have a day, you can take it away. Like you don't have to be at work. It's paid. Go. And it is highly encouraged. Like go get away, like be quiet, go to Millerton, do what you need to do and take a day. We get a wellness benefit every month. So $50 every month, everyone on staff. You could buy vitamins, you could go get your nails done, you can go do yoga, whatever it looks like for you, take that time for yourself. That's on me as a staff member to take advantage of those things. Every week on a Thursday, we start most of our staff meetings like in a moment of quiet, taking deep breaths, rolling our shoulders back, planting our feet. That's on me if I want to partake in that. So.
Yeah. No, I think you can provide options. You can provide options, but people have to take it. Like the whole thing about most Americans don't take their vacation time because they're, you know, to use Christian language, idolatrous with their work. Their meaning comes from it. And then they get convinced that if they are not fully in, then somehow they're lesser. I don't know. There's just an obsession with work culture that I think inhibits most people. Is that your experience, Andrew?
Yeah. And I was going to say, I feel a responsibility as the ED to set the table, but I can't force anybody. And like any of my staff know, like when I see their vacation hours piling up, I'm like, you're literally giving me money. Like I have already given this to you. You're wasting money. Like it's just money you're leaving on the table because I want you to get away. Do get away. Even if you stay in town, I don't care. Turn off your computer, you know? So I grew up with a workaholic parent and I think those wounds are deep, but I think they made an impression on me of like, what is important in life? And I love my work. I think our work is very important work and I find meaning and value in it. I ain't going to put my identity in it because there's a certain point too, it'll not love me back. And whereas my kids will want my attention, you know?
Yeah. Do-gooders will work all day long. Like our staff, like we will go. And so it's so important that we actually take a minute to quiet down our souls and get away.
You can't give if you got nothing to give.
That's right.
All right. So we're going to jump into a section that kind of intrigued me. And I want to talk about Christian community development, the CCD concept. Are there any issues with doing Christian community develop in a non-Christian community?
Oh, so really, I think what it is, Christian community development, historic, you know, maybe about 50 years, at least in the States. And, you know, as an idea, it has frames elsewhere, but it's a group of Christians that were committed to loving their city, investing in the city instead of, you know, you think about the 50s suburban white flight. It was the opposite reaction to say, actually, like those places matter and we have to be close to the pain of our community, not just run away from it. And so those that are actually close to the pain are the best positioned to solve those communities' problems. For me, it's a bit of a worldview, right? It's a way of seeing others. One of the things I think even in some of your questions that sets us apart is like, it's an asset-based mindset. We believe that there's inherent dignity in every community. We believe every single person has something to give, gifts, talents, abilities. And so the way we enter space is not as the savior of a community, but as somebody to partner alongside, to lift up and give folks the space to believe in themselves for a minute. Cause like poverty just beats you down. It can constantly tell you, you don't have enough, you aren't good enough. And so a group of people rally around and then we go, oh yeah, like we actually have something to give here. Like we can actually be part of a solution. And then, you know, everybody needs connectors, resources, folks that connect them to the goods and the people of society. So for me, it's about like, it's a mentality that I think comes from a faith worldview. But I find people all the time who I'm like, you live this vision. You don't hold the same faith, but like ultimately, like your vision of an asset-based world is there. I think the difference of Christian community development is like, we think the church is important for folks to find community. You know, I hope folks get to know Jesus at some point. Like, but again, it's not coming with, that's the end goal. Like just this like dichotomous salvation. It's about like you experiencing like your water being clean, that the road works for you, that you have an amazing school. Like that the living environment you are in now changes. That's what is holistic about Christian community development. Whereas I think most churches have left that vision to the side, and it's about like this, again, Western soul saving versus your body.
That's what I was kind of implying that in the question. I wanted you to contrast mission work with what Christian community development is. Now that I put it more on the nose, is there anything you want to add in terms of the contrast between those two projects?
I think we were just talking about this morning. Walk, if you've ever been on any type of missions trip, it can be really, everyone gives like the example of like going down to Mexico and building a house. And then you walk away and you have no idea who lives in that house. You have no idea if that house is even structurally sound enough for them to continue to live in that house. There's no long-term investment co-collaboration happening between you and the individual. It's all about what I did and now what I receive in return, not necessarily what that family is going, like how they're impacted for the long run. And so I think bringing that here, zooming in on Fresno and what we do, everything we do, it's like we're in this for the long run with these people, 15 years of work. And so, and we have like actual personal relationships with people. It's not about like how it makes me feel or what I do to, feel better about how I shared the gospel or whatever it might be. It's about how do I show up and be a resource and be a friend to somebody, be an actual neighbor.
Yeah. Sometimes it feels like when I talk to people about mission work, they kind of think about it like in those movies where they're dropping like, like aid behind enemy lines, and they're dropping these like with the little white parachutes, and then it drops down, and then, oh, they get it and they open it up, and you know, it's self-explanatory, but it's just not. So under this kind of umbrella, one of the components that's listed is redistribution, which I mean, can you pick a more loaded word these days? I mean, you know, we all live in a redistributive society, so pretending that we don't is just absurd. But, you know, it is one of those kind of buzzwords. Can you spell out what that exactly means in the context of your guys' work?
What it means is when I have the chance, even as an office, right? I got a chance to hire somebody to clean the office, right? Am I going to use the relational connection, the opportunity I have to hire somebody? Am I going to reach out to a resident that we work with and say, hey, would you be willing to hire and clean our office? And she says, yes, that's who's currently cleaning our office. I can hire a firm. I can hire a big company.
Or the person with 5 stars on Yelp.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I have the opportunity to use the resources I've been given to go back to those that I'm coming alongside in other ways, right? And to create a mutuality in that. So for me, it's literally like, you all have gifts, talents, and abilities. Are you using those for others? Like you've been given education, obviously money, but you've been given skills and knowledge. How are those being reinvested into a community? There's been a lot of longitudinal like Facebook studies recently that have actually said that folks that are in poverty, just one of the main things of poverty is it isolates you. You do not have social connection. And so you begin to hang out with the folks in your neighborhood who in Fresno are also poor. And then you are isolated as a whole instead of having relationships in North Fresno, in Clovis. And so how do we create social cohesion? That's redistribution. It's just you using your relational capital that you have to connect to somebody else's relational capital who doesn't have it, right?
Yeah, that class diversity.
Yeah.
Would you say that the One Fresno campaign that we see the little signs is an example of what CCD means by reconciliation, or is there some differences there?
I mean, in vision and in simple platitudes, maybe, right? Like, I love the idea, like in a sense of like One Fresno. Yeah. Like that is a dream world I do want to live in. We are a One Fresno like that. Yes. And in that sense. Now that means a whole nother thing between an administration behind it, their policies, how they institute those, how do they actually go about living into One Fresno? Like that's a whole nother question. So yes, I love it. I think it's a good vision. And some of the things that, Dyer and his administration have done actually have lived into that and that I really would embrace homelessness, some of the like economic development pieces. Obviously there's a ton of other things that go, that's playing your side. That's playing politics. But yeah. So That's me avoiding your loaded question, Jordan.
Of course. Well, I have to ask it. So we're going to jump to my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you and you tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. You can both answer if you'd like, or you can just do one at a time. So the first one is Isaiah among the major prophets. Is he over or underrated? Or them, I guess.
I did not see the question going there.
You could say them or he or she if you prefer.
How dare you? I would say it's still underrated because I don't think people actually like read it.
Yeah, they don't know
and
it.
Live
yeah.
into it. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And we use it for one of our like, you know, theological visions of the new creation. So it's underrated.
Yeah. Well, and I think people.
All the prophets are underrated.
Yeah, is the worst prophet? Yeah. No, I think people skip 50 or so chapters and then jump to some things in the 60s has been my experience. Mm-hmm. But next one. But we digress. Next one, me and Ed's Pizza.
Oh, overrated.
Okay, you both were in line, so explain. Either in unison again, please.
I'm a Fresno transplant.
Same.
And so it's so just
I'm like,
we're
makers
all
about
this. Yes, it's like... It's just a cardboard. People who grew up here love it. And I'm just like, it's trash. But
it's literally the same.
Not good.
Has that created a conflict
dish
in your personal life?
Like, deeper dish pizza that they have. Oh, but like, I'm like, if it's 20, it's like In-N-Out fries. Yes. That's how I feel about me. That's like 20 minutes later, I'm like, this tastes like,
Yeah. It usually is a certain hour after a certain activity for me, but that's a different subject. Yeah.
But we digress again.
Yeah. Next one. And this is something that I've watched a lot of people go through, a faith deconstruction.
Underrated.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah. So I have so many feels on this.
Well, maybe expand upon your feels because I recently was talking to someone and they were like, you know, it's kind of nauseating when people are trapped forever in this deconstruction phase. Like just destroy the house already. And so you can like figure out how to build your new house, but you're just so obsessed. They're like literally like taking one brick down at a time. They take one brick at a time. And it's almost like they just love being in that state of taking the bricks apart from the house. So why don't you expand on what you meant?
I think that it's really easy. Like it's really easy to look, if you're critiquing deconstruction from an outsider's perspective and you're not deconstructing or you haven't deconstructed, that it just looks like that, like, oh, they're just wallowing and complaining and it's this long drawn out process, or it just looks like they're quitting, like, which is really like, that's like the worst critique is like, you just quit a faith. I think that it's so necessary, especially if you grew up in the church. If you have like adopted some type of system, religious structure, faith structure, and at some point maybe you made it your own, but at the same time, there was a lot of it that you adopted. It's on you to deconstruct a lot of that and to make sure that it's yours. So I think it's like, I think we've used these now buzzwords that really, everyone has their own definition of what that word even means now. But I think that it's essential if you actually want to, I think people with that have done that work are some of like the most honest people that I know, that they've decided to actually splay it out loud on the table and go, okay, what's mine and what's not mine anymore.
Yeah. It's, to me, it's like, it's just a function of, are you growing up emotionally? And, you know, and so you come, we give kids an easy package, right? It's very pretty and there's pictures and colors and everything. And then as you actually experience life, you're like, this is a hell of a lot messier than I could have imagined. And so at some point you have to relook at it and go like, okay, I was handed, especially a lot of us were handed a very protected version. And so you have to reexamine it and go, what is still true? What are other folks saying about this? Does it actually hold any like, I think in the current moment, like the everybody's throwing off what's there, but like, we don't know what's coming when we don't actually have a shared worldview and a shared way of thinking about life. And I think a lot of people are hungry for something that is like more true and beautiful, but you have to go through that process. And whether you stay or go, I think it's really important that you go through something where you're pulling apart or else you're just not growing.
Yeah. My input, I believe that the word deconstruction implies that you will reconstruct and you will reconstruct whichever way you decide, but at some point you will rebuild something and you'll hold to something. And so it's, what will you hold to is really more the question, and less about like, what am I killing? Which is, I think, the angst that you're describing is like, this is just taking, you know, such a long time to process through. Probably, yeah, because there's hurt there and lots of things that people are processing through. So what is mine to have for the forever, or for the next season of my life until I do another one? You know, it doesn't have to be a one-time thing.
I think it feels similar to people coming out. You know, I have had friends that like came out, and it, like, once they realized it was like a week later, they, everyone knew. And then, yeah, I have friends that are almost 40 and are still working through that process. And it's just, you know, just depends on the person, you know, it depends on how crazy their family members are. All right. Next one.
I was going to say it and parents.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Next one. And this is just because I went to the MCC sale last weekend. Quilts, over underrated.
So underrated.
Oh, I'm going overrated. I grew up in that community where, you know, I was just there too. I was there on Saturday, and there's quilts everywhere. There's auctions. I'm like, I mean, sure, colors, squares, triangles. That's cool.
I've asked to ride in the spinning bed thing. You know how they spin the bed so they can set it up, and that was turned down.
I think quilts were invented before we have like this now comfy like fabric. Like
down, right? Yeah. Down,
like, we have down better down fabrics. Let's move on.
Oh, I'm sad for the ladies that are making the quilts.
Yes, he has just lost so many listeners. So, all right, next one. Hiking in the High Sierras, over underrated.
Definitely underrated. Yeah, I now have a group of guys who, we just did the Eastern Edge this last summer. So we're doing a trip every summer. And I mean, just in the wild, nothing around. It feels like we're going to, you know, die. It's just like, it's unbelievable, breathtaking, unbelievable. So yes.
Yeah, I enjoy it too. I remember one time I went a long one with a group of guys, and it was after we had a late night the night before, so it wasn't wise. And I remember they put a bunch of cans of beer in one of the backpacks, and they were like, this is the treat when we get to the top. And we get to the top, and they're just like as warm as like a cup of coffee sitting in someone's sweat pool in their backpack. And I just remember drinking that warm beer and still being in the happiest place on earth. So yes, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. All right. Next one. Both of you, Dodgers or Giants?
Oh, easy. Dodgers.
Neither.
Neither. Okay. Fair enough.
Big Dodgers.
Next one. Hebrew tattoos, over underrated.
Well played. I got one.
Okay. I have one too. So you think they're underrated still, even after you've had it for a while?
I'd probably now go a little overrated. Yeah.
Don't be so hard on yourself.
I got a new one coming though. I do. I finally have a new tattoo appointment. So
younger Andrew loved that tattoo.
It is true.
Yeah.
It's a record of our poor decisions. Well, mine is. I don't know. I'm on the fence.
What do you got? What does yours say?
Mine says hallelujah, which I got at age of 20. And I have them around both ankles. And so when people ask what it means, I say regret is one side and laser removal is expensive on the other side, because that's how I feel. So two more sections before we wrap up with books. Why have you chosen to focus? Well, actually, hold on. What are the most overlooked assets in your mind in Fresno?
Oh, it's always the people. I think we have people are usable, discardable, that like not everybody is my brother and my sister. So I think it's people. Like we see people with half-hearted eyes, and, you know, based on your own background, culture, assumptions, you know, you just see a guy with tats up here and you just go like, that's guy's trash. And so I think it's people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd say yes to that. And downtown. I think downtown, there's so much potential. I'd love to, in my lifetime, see it become a really beautiful space to be.
If I could throw one more out there, I would say it's the smog, but like if Fresno, if you could see this, you know, the mountain skyline every day, I think we would be this like Denver-esque culture where people are always outside. Hiking's just part of life. But I think because it feels literally like you can't see it, it feels removed. Mm-hmm. We are actually like, you know, it's far away. But having now gotten into hiking, starting to do it a little bit more, I'm like, dude, we're so close to so many amazing things. So,
100%. And I remember I did this podcast probably years ago at this point where someone made a really wise point. I'm not sure if it was Craig Sharton or someone, but they said that Fresno developed in the wrong, in the opposite direction that it should have. Downtown should be the San Joaquin River, and there should, like Chicago or like any of these places that have a river that runs through it. It would just change the whole outlook of the city if there was a river in the middle.
So true. I never heard anybody say that. That's great.
Let's talk about volunteers, talking about assets or liabilities, depending on who they are. How long does it take you to train and develop high quality volunteers? And this is a two-part question. Do you think sometimes it's better for just a really stellar employee just to do work themselves rather than just train people to do or create an inferior product that they could just manage themselves?
Yeah, that's good. I think it really goes to skill and then what you're volunteering for. So we have a literacy program, right? You come to two trainings. So those take about 3 hours total. We'll place you, train you. You could be, you know, from signing up to being placed in 2 weeks, right? To in a school reading with kids. That takes a kit. You're trained on it. This is what you do. It's repeatable. So I think volunteers often have a really bad experience because they don't get support. They don't have adequate training and they don't have the right tools. And so their experience is really poor. What then we see is as a volunteer is comfortable, then the teacher will start saying, hey, Mr. Johnson, can you help me like do this with the kids? And so now they start to become useful to the teacher. They start to do other things in the classroom. And now they're more confident in that as well. Then they start growing. So I think like, I kind of look at it like you need easy on-ramp experiences for folks to figure out what they are good at, what they love to do. And then they find that thing, they become an expert at it. And then they're like a high quality volunteer. Or, you know, they become staff on a nonprofit and, you know, or staff at wherever. So I definitely think there are a lot of spaces. EMP runs a lot of meetings, trainings, workshops. I don't want to volunteer there. I need somebody that is an expert at navigating tension and conflict and how to, you know, transition folks that are talking too long. And, you know, that's a skill, that's an art. So we put our staff in those roles. Our volunteers, we put in very different roles, right? So I think you need those easy on-ramp opportunities. And then you also, time and skill give you somebody who's an amazing staff member.
Okay. Let's say that someone that was an observer of your organization, all they had was your partnership map. They didn't have any information about anything else you do. What kind of conclusions would they derive about you guys just by looking only at that partnership map?
Good question. I think that they would see two things. I think they'd see that we're south of Shaw. We spend a lot of time in Fresno Unified elementary schools that get less funding than other schools and are performing below average. And we focus there on purpose. I think the other thing that they would notice is that we are, how do I want to say this? There's more to do. We are, I think, 14 different neighborhoods right now.
No, we're about 25.
25. Now. Wow, I'm off. 25 neighborhoods.
14 Saturday
sports. There you go. Thank you. I got my numbers mixed up. We're at 25 neighborhoods, and there's a lot. There's how many elementary schools?
92.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's more to do. And we really can grow at the pace of volunteers. And so people are looking at a partnership map. I hope that they would see that there's space for them and that we'd love to have them join us.
Yeah. When you flip over that map on the backside, you see a list of every school, how long that school has been a partner. And then you see all the list of partners at that elementary school site. So our dream would be, one, they like to collaborate. And then two.
Yeah. We just had a donor event recently and Andrew said our dream, and this is true. Our dream would be that every single elementary school would have either a partner church, organization, or business that if they have an issue or a need, they could call. And that's still the vision is that, we would collaborate together for a better Fresno.
Fantastic. As someone that's worked in public education for a long time, I know that how schools, their educational goals and their strategies that they use to attain those can be wildly different from school district to school district and even school to school. How do you make sure that what you're doing aligns with the goals of, let's say, Fresno and Central Unified, for example? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a lot of our curriculum. So this literacy program I was mentioning, it's all done in partnership. So it starts with us asking, you know, we saw, you know, this comes from learning experience. We were partnering volunteers to serve in the elementary school classrooms. A lot of those were falling away. And we began to just say like, this isn't working. We don't know why. Let's figure it out, right? So we started asking that question, found out like teacher's too tired. They don't have time to train a volunteer, or the volunteer is just kind of sitting there waiting. They're not taking initiative. So this just wasn't a great, like this dating kind of thing we were doing wasn't working. And so that's where we came up with literacy mentoring. We started asking the districts, hey, what would you hope a kindergarten or a first grade volunteer could do? And they said sight words, literacy skills. So our first iteration of it was like a sight word list. That was good. And then we began to learn, like, we're kind of just like helping kids memorize lists. And that is better than nothing, but that's still not actually giving kids the tools to read. Like, we're not unlocking that code for them yet. And so we then redesigned our curriculum again to where now, like, we've had some Fresno Unified Teaching literacy coaches come into our classrooms. Mm-hmm. They don't know who we are. They just, you know, see these folks volunteering. And then they're like, hey, can I get that kit material? Like, that's really good stuff I want to do with my kids, right? So it's a lot of like being a learner posture in collaboration with the district. Right now we're working on an after-school program design in the Edison region of Fresno Unified. So we're co-designing the curriculum with the principals and their teaching specialists. So it's all collaboration and, mm-hmm. you know, being humble enough to go, I think we've got some stuff, but let's learn.
And I would add to that, anyone who's listening, like, that sounds so lovely. It's a process of listening.
Yes.
Like messy process of listening and back and forth. And so I have found that EMP is willing to go slow if it means better.
Well, you guys got to be careful promoting how efficacious your educational programs are. You might become education consultants by the end of this.
Now, we're not mad about that.
Yeah. I mean, it pays well. Now, this is kind of a little bit of another either or question, but it's something I hear a lot, especially in political spaces where there's a lot of people that say, you know, you can't fix education without fixing poverty first. And if you do an ACEs questionnaire and then you track educational outcomes, they're highly correlated. There's a lot of things that impact a student's mm-hmm. ability to read, for example. Mm-hmm. And so what would you say to someone that says it's a waste of time and space trying to fix education because it's so broken at this point? We should really just focus our attention on poverty, and then there will be ripple effects to every part of society, including our schools.
I think that again goes to this like either or choice. That's mm-hmm. just a false dichotomy. Yeah,
the question is broken.
Yeah. Because I think you're not wrong. Everything's broken. Everything in our society is broken. We need folks on every end of this spectrum. That's just how I see it, is like, we need folks that are still supporting the kids in our systems, because all that means is you leave them alone. You cast them aside. They need somebody that looks at them and says, you're special. You can do something. And then I think we need folks working on economic development, right? We need housing solutions. We need mental health care support, right? So like for us, we know, I think what happens is you start to really understand the multifaceted iceberg under what you see is like kids aren't reading at grade level. Under that is an iceberg issue of all these competing factors. I can do my part. Mm-hmm. Right. I need every person listening to do their part, to get engaged somewhere in that system. And then collectively we begin to see movement. So yeah, I don't love the question.
Yeah. And like, I think people would see like even what we do, like a school, like that's education. We see it as a hub, like that elementary school is the hub of that neighborhood, which means all those layers of that are underneath it. So those parents that are dropping off their kids at school are the leaders of that neighborhood. They are the influencers of what they want to see done. We believe that like 110%. And so instead of breaking things up into false dichotomies, it would probably be better to see it as like, if we broke it up into areas of influence, how could we make change and how could we resource those that already have the assets?
Yeah, I think you guys answered it perfectly, which is that it's a stacked question, which is... Yeah. There are things that have larger impacts. Like yeah. we know poverty has a large impact, but if you look at, for example, there's a famous paper by this guy named Raj Chetty, who's kind of a mm-hmm. leading economist that looks at the efficacy of a really qualified teacher having a group of students and the impact that has on their long-term earnings, mental health, et cetera. And, you know, I don't want to get into p-values, but there's a big impact. And so there are stages. I think you guys answered that perfectly. Now, I do want to talk about efficacy, though. How do you measure the efficacy of the dollars you guys spend on an individual project?
Yeah, that is a great question. That is an incredibly difficult question for any nonprofit to answer. And if I had a research institute that wanted to come and join and partner alongside of us, Fresno State, Fresno City, whoever, would love to have you all join us, because part of it is like, we try our best to say, what are markers? Each project is so wildly different. It's intended audience, right? So some of our stuff is funded by grants. We, you know, the metrics up front, we're measuring those metrics. Some of it isn't, right? And we're just going like, we're going to do this program, whether there's money there or not, because we believe it's important. And then we're tracking the things that, like, we know donors think is important. Like this last year, we had over like $903,000 of volunteer hours, right? So you can say, hey, when you give to us, we're going to multiply your money in volunteer engagement. And so almost $1 million of hours of volunteer work got done through EMP last year, right? So yes and no. What I want to get to, our dream scenario, and we're currently working on this. I would love to have like an empowerment index, right? So I could tell you, hey, when you give to EMP, you know, the folks that work with us, 90% of them, when they were done working with us, said, I felt more empowered. So like, that's a metric that we feel like that would test what we say we're about. That would actually prove it. If I could tell you, hey, these 20 orgs worked with us last year, they felt more empowered after working with us. So that's a metric I want to get to, because I think it gets to our value in the world.
Yeah, it is tricky to measure things. I mean, that's why, you know, the effective altruism movement and givewell.org was created, because there are a lot of organizations that don't spend money well. Yeah. And telling, donor dollars were spent, what does that tell them? But it sounds like what you're aspiring to is kind of a mixture of quantitative and qualitative feedback, you know, qualitative being like, how does my program make you feel? And how did it empower you? But also, like, I can show you our volunteers are in classrooms X number of hours. Now, determining whether if something is efficacious or not is tricky. Like, let's say you had a group of volunteers, they're really good literacy coaches, and they also happen to be in a classroom with an effective teacher. How do you disentangle those? You can't. Exactly.
That's the challenge. I could tell you, oh yeah, across our board, our literacy rates were, you know, kids increased their literacy rate. Well, is that because they were in class all day? Is it because of our program, because of their teacher, because of that school's, you know, ethos? Like, yes.
Yeah.
Very complicated.
Okay, here's another one kind of on that subject. What's an example of a project that appeared successful on the exterior, but when you dug into it, you realized it wasn't the thing that you set out to do?
Ooh, that's a great one.
Because a lot of projects, and I work in nonprofit spaces, like, you can make something, you can tie a bow on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to do a postmortem and get honest that it's not going the way that you'd hoped, even if on the exterior it looks like everyone's busy, you know? So I was curious if you had one.
I can answer, because I was thinking of one. You could do the battery if you want to. Yeah. We have just recently shifted. We used to provide, if, like, say a youth group came to us and wanted to do a spring break project, we would set it up. We'd connect them with the partner. We'd also provide all of the supplies that they needed to make that day happen. So we would do lunches. We would do, if they needed trash picker uppers, all those things. And then we would host that day for them. We've actually switched from that, just realizing that it's not necessarily where we want to be, and kind of continuing to support that idea of, like, you come into a place, you fix it, that benefits you, not necessarily them. It wasn't the best type of partnership, and it's not the type of partner that we want to be long-term. And so we've moved away from that. We still have all that stuff in our storage unit. And so we still want to be that partner. So if a church or a youth group or whoever came to us for a spring break type thing said, hey, we want to do this, we would 110% be like, yes, you should talk to so-and-so. Here, let me connect you guys. But EMP wouldn't necessarily be like the host of that thing, if that makes sense. It's just not the best use of our time and the most effective use of our time, especially as we've grown in the last couple of years. So I think that's a shift that we've made, that maybe if people are familiar with us over the years, it's probably one of the more front-facing things that we did. And we've had to make a shift and go, yeah, that's not where we want to be long-term. We're still about it. We're still about serving in your city and being a part of that thing, but we don't necessarily need to be like the service host of those projects.
Yeah. Your resources are limited and you got to use them wisely. Absolutely.
Yes. And we want to get upstream of the problem. So getting kids out there is great. Cleaning up trash, sure, great. But like, why has the city disinvested in Southwest Fresno? How do we actually address land use policy, right? So we now have a class that is called Community Land Use Academy, that's training residents to understand the built environment and how do they impact the built environment? How do they legislate and get the empty lot turned into something they would like, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. I ask this question to everybody. So I think wherever we work or choose to work, that affects kind of our how we see things. And so as someone that works in education, I tend to see the world through education problems and education solutions. That's just kind of natural. Like I said before, my partner's a clinical psychologist. She tends to see the world through psychological problems and solutions. It's just natural. How has what you guys do affected the way you see Fresno?
Well, I think I have a very, I don't have the most holistic view, but I have a very clear sense that it takes the whole community because I understand how deep-rooted these problems are. I'm in meetings that one day we're talking about the biggest issue is housing affordability and housing access and housing stock, right? And we're talking about long-term, how do we change that? The next conversation I'm good to is really about homelessness and the challenges facing homelessness and then next to it's education, right? So I'm in these meetings where it feels like my brain kind of goes insane sometimes because I'm thinking about all the complexity that it's going to take. But recognizing that, yeah, this is multifaceted. Mm-hmm. There's not one thing is going to solve this problem in our community. And so we really need a multidimensional approach that is holistic, that, you know, values our families, but is economic and is, you know, so I think it's like very comprehensive in the way that like, I don't have this magic wand thinking, but I think it's going to take everything.
Mm-hmm. I think the greatest thing EMP has given me is I can like tell this quick story. I was in the car with a friend and we were driving past a spot and she's like, gosh, it's such a dump. And I knew the org who was working there, the people who are living there, the people who are investing into that neighborhood. And so I don't see it as a dump. I see it as like, that's where people have given their lives to serve the people of that neighborhood. And so I think that's the sweetest thing that EMP has given me is a hope, like a hope for our city and also like how much hard work it's going to take to see the results that we want. I think it's really easy, especially in Fresno and our urban environments. You drive 20 minutes south and it looks so different than the north. And so it's easy to get really negative, even if you have a concept of faith or a faith framework. It's very easy to get negative. And so I think that's the best thing that we do for our city is we educate, we teach, and then we teach people how to hope and then how they can like directly get involved to continue to build that hope. That being said, we have a drive tour that everyone should go on so that they can also learn more. You literally get in your car, you turn on your iPhone on your app, and it'll drive you around the city and show you signs of hope. And so I would encourage anyone to do that.
That sounds fantastic. I used to do those when I lived in different cities. I would like, it was a library. I was a very nerdy 20-year-old, but I would do walking tours of San Francisco and
yeah.
I would go in different parts of the city. And, you know, I think it really just having through someone's eyes, a city is super helpful. Before we close with books, I want to talk about podcast, the desire to create it and the goals and then what you've learned so far.
Yeah. So we launched a podcast, I don't know, now about a month or two ago. It really came from, I mean, I've been an OG podcast when it was work, right? Like you had to, you know, connect your phone to iTunes and upload them. Like this is back like 07 or maybe 05, I think 05 probably. I did one. I used to work at FPU in their athletic department. So I did a podcast for 6 months over there when no one listened. And I probably had two listens, but I love the medium. So that's part of it. And then I love just, you know, a lot of my work is sitting down with these amazing people all day in meetings, or I'll take somebody to lunch or coffee. I have an awesome conversation with them. And then I'm like, what a jewel. What an amazing human that's doing stuff that I could never imagine. And so part of it is just like, how do I sit down with these people more publicly? How do people get introduced? We did an interview with Kim Contreras. She lives on Belmont, lived there, you know, 15, 20 years. On Fridays, she's out walking with prostitutes and trying just to give them a safe house, right? Like that's unbelievable. I would never do that. And I'm not going to do that, but like, this is an awesome human being that others should know about. So I think similar to probably you and why you've been doing this, like there's great people in this city I want to introduce to and learn from. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm learning this.
Yeah. I think for when we were chatting about too, is like the accessibility of every neighborhood partnership, we've grown so much. If people have heard about us, like, oh, you're the people who do Saturday sports, which is we open up green space on a Saturday for a public schools and kids can come and play. We're so much more than that. And we've built and it's bigger. And anyways, that the podcast allows us that very simple on-ramp. If someone wants to get to know what we're doing, an org, a partner, they can just pop it in and, you know, listen on their app. So that's the hope, is that you don't have to necessarily come volunteer with us for months on end to know about us. You can just get to know us through easy and accessible way.
Fantastic. And what have you learned so far?
Oh man, I've learned how to record on a device instead of mics. I think the other thing that I think has been interesting, and somebody said this as we wrapped up and I felt it too, is, and you would obviously have this experience, that like after a certain period of time, there's just people get in the zone with you and they're like, kind of forget that the world exists a little bit. And so they're just more present. And that's been an interesting, like, that's different than any other medium. When you're shooting a video on somebody, it just does, that doesn't happen. Like this feels like all of a sudden they take off their headphones and they're like, whoa. Like I'm in another world. And so I think that's been a really special emotional connecting kind of place that I did not expect to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can truly kind of black out and then it's 2 hours later and you're like, what happened? I've had that experience. I actually had that experience in yoga yesterday. I was in the Shavasana and I had this pillow underneath me and I fell asleep and my wife was sitting next to me and I was like drooling down my face. So, all right, let's close with books. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
So my two was, just finished American Dirt. It's like a immigration story narrative. Really good. I really enjoyed it. It's almost like it reads like a thriller, but very empathy building, especially in our current political season. I imagine immigration will be a hot topic. So that was a great one. And then over my sabbatical, I had a break this summer. I read The Power of Saying No. So that's also been a good book. As somebody who, you know, I wouldn't call myself a people pleaser, but I am. I really want people to like me. And so to say no feels like I'm disappointing them. And so that's been a good book that's been helpful since the summer.
Mm-hmm. I'm currently reading She Deserves Better by Sheila Gregoire and her daughter. And they surveyed 25,000 evangelical women on their experiences around purity culture. Insane, the stats they're getting out and how that's affected women in their marriages and their sex lives. And so I would highly recommend, and also like how to raise your daughters in a different way. And then to go back to like your original question of Jesus-centered, I'm sure this has been told on your podcast before, but Jesus and John Wayne. So good. I don't know if
you've heard about that. You're the first one to recommend this. Oh, so explain.
Come on. Such a good book. That is like, I think, a helpful recentering too of how we define who Jesus is.
Fantastic. Well, to close, let's go check out your podcast. Is it available on all major platforms? And the title of the podcast is, for listeners,
What's Good in the Neighborhood.
What's Good in the Neighborhood. Fantastic. And then if people are just interested in learning more about ENP and how to get involved, how do they do that?
Yeah, you can find us on Instagram. We're at EMP Fresno, and our website is everyneighborhood.org.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate you guys doing this. This was a lot of fun, and I'm excited to continue to listen to your podcast and watch what you guys are up to in the city. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.